afternoon. Is it working? Yes.
All right.
Well, my name is Sarah Smelas. I'm a senior fellow, and I participated in the Amsterdam program in 2014. For the next section of the program, I will introduce Antje Scheidler. She's the moderator of the panel Reclaiming Spaces, New Forms of Civic and Political Engagement. Antje has been with Humanity in Action since 2002, when she became the program director of the German Fellowship Program. And since 2007, she has been the national director of the German Chapter of Humanity in Action, and is now the international director of European programs of the organization. So please join me in welcoming Antje.
Can I take this one? Much better. So thank you for the very warm welcome. I would like to welcome our two panelists to the stage. Barbara Nowacka, who joins us from Poland. And Sophie Ellman-Golan from the United States. So first of all, this little tornado that we were all struck with on Thursday has even implications until today, because as you probably saw in the program, we were supposed to be three here. Now, Air Berlin doesn't have its act together. Marton, who was supposed to join us from Hungary this morning, is still in Budapest. He can't come because they canceled his flight, so I don't know whether he figures out something to be with us tonight for the party. I don't know whether he can actually physically come, but we will try to Skype him in the afternoon, sort of that at least you get his perspective through Skype. We hope that it will work, but this is why for now we have a panel with two women, two power women. I know there are websites created that say like, hey, congratulations, you created an all-male panel. Now we have an all-female panel here. Also in terms of the curation of this panel, I think the goal for this panel is a very different one from other panels that we had during this conference. We were thinking like, okay, you know, we have an audience of 250 Humanity in Action people. Many of you who are new fellows will have to, or are looking totally forward to implementing your projects within the year after the fellowship program. And the senior fellows who happen to be in the room are the ones who already implemented their projects or are still sort of in the implementation phase. And this is why we thought in our conference on nationalism and populism and right-wing movements, and we cannot stop short analyzing what's going on and talking about the contexts we live in. We also need to talk about what could be done. And this is why we thought we bring people to the table who are very engaged, who are activists, who are political minds, who take their responsibility in terms as sort of citizens in their country, to take the fate of that country into their hands very seriously. And where we thought it would be interesting for all of us to learn from them. We all have a certain set of experiences in terms of project implementation. I'm sure all of us who implement projects know the feeling of failing. Things go wrong, you try not to repeat the mistakes. And so we thought we would like to engage in a conversation about what worked out very well, what maybe didn't work well, what's good practice advice. Also, maybe talk a little bit about surprising effects of when you get civically engaged. Are there maybe new partners on the radar that you weren't aware of? And so this is why we have invited Sophie and Barbara to join us. Now, let me start with Sophie. She traveled the longest way Sophie joined us from New York, and I hope you enjoyed the time with the conference. I think you kind of get the spirit. Sophie Ellman-Golan is the Deputy Head of Socials and Outreach at Women's March, and I think, generally speaking, you're a feminist at heart. You're an activist. You're very involved in matters of racial and gender justice, queer liberation, and also police violence. And you've sort of have been, before joining the Women's March, be involved with campaigning for police accountability. You're also very active in the Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. So, someone who is living activism, and yesterday we talked at length about the political climate in the United States in which sort of particular forms of resistance are currently taking place. Now, Barbara, also a feminist, also an activist, what I've you sort of have also a history of being politically involved, but for this session we want to focus on the activism part, and really learn from you as a campaigner. Towards the end of 2016, in the fall, many of us have seen those pictures from the so-called black protests in Poland, not just in Warsaw, but in other cities. And Barbara has become, at the time, a leading figure in organizing this protest. And I would like to start with a question to you, since we have talked a little bit about Hungary, we talked a lot about Germany and the US, whether you maybe could sketch out for the audience the political climate at the time when you sort of started to work on the campaign, what sort of were the driving forces behind it and what prompted this action?
Well, thank you very much. It's my great pleasure to be here with you, especially that before we started our panel, you already had a very good explanation of what's going on in Poland. The film Girl Power, the presentation that was given, actually showed parts of atmosphere, and I must say I'm still touched while seeing the photos from the protest that for the first time, first of all, managed to stop far-right ruling Poland from taking human right away from women, which was a big success. And secondly, protests that involved not only those who were convinced to the cause, but those who felt touched enough to organize protests not only in the big cities, but also sometimes in the villages and towns. And I think that was great success of Polish women movement that was actually growing from the late 80s. But was never that strong, and I think, but now I think we might be stronger and stronger. Situation in Poland, you've heard about Hungary, you talked a lot about United States, so it's similar. It's similar because right-wing running the country is starting something I could describe not only about Poland, but about the world. It's kind of fight on fundamental values. Fight on how democracy should look like, or should we have a liberal democracy, or shouldn't we question the ideas of democracy, as much as the fight how far right and the others see human right. Are human rights a primary issue while building law structures and society and the institutions, or there are some other priorities like family, religion, identity, nation, that should have more right than individual human, that individual human being. And with the vision of far right that is saying that they don't care about institutions, they don't care about a voice of single person, they don't really care about human right. They care about nation, their vision, and strengthening the nationalist point of view, even in the environment of European Union. When they got to power, they started to destroy institutions and limit right of men, women, minorities, LGBT, migrants, and so on and so on. Situation is not good at all. People went on the streets to march in the protest to fight for constitutional tribunals, so independence of juridical system. People went on the street to march to support our presence in the European Union. But they didn't care. They didn't care until 3rd of October came, and that was the first moment the right wingers said, okay, we are stepping back. We are not changing the law. Why? That was the introduction about the climate. Now I can talk about the real activism. In Poland, women's rights were always questioned. Although we were one of the very first to have the right to vote in 1918, we were very first that were allowed to study at the universities as Polish women. We were kind of strong in our societies because of the wars. Women had a very important role in the society. So it was not like in France and the other countries where women were pushed back and kept at home until 70s. No, in Poland it was a little bit different. Though some fundamental rights of women were questioned constantly, especially after the changes in 1989, where although we won with communism, many of politicians started to support Christian Catholic Church. And Christian Catholic Church started to oppress women's rights and women equality, especially in the part of having access to legal abortion. For mainstream, it was always considered as a non-important topic because they don't understand the most important part of discussion of the abortion, or they don't want to understand. If we believe that humans are equal, they should have equal right to decide upon their bodies. If a state questions women's right to decide when she wants to have kids or with whom she wants to have kids, then all her role in society can be questioned. And this is the fight we are having constantly. And we had this discussion in Poland. In Poland, there is a conservative law actually banning abortion. And in 2016, ultra-conservative group wanted to have it even more radical. And then we started our campaign, but I think I will refer to the campaign in the next intervention.
Sophie, maybe you could talk a little bit about the run-up to the Women's March as it took place in the United States, along the lines that Barbara sketched out.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. And it's really exciting to get to be here with you, particularly having watched what happened in Poland and the fight for the right, for women's rights to exert control over our own bodies is really inspiring. And you should know that as we planned, one of the follow-up actions we had to the Women's March was for International Women's Day. We called it Day Without a Woman, and it was an accompaniment to the International Women's Strike. We really looked to Poland and to the Black Marches as a source of inspiration for that. So thank you. Leading up to the march, I think everyone knows that it was a sort of shocking time. November 9th was a shocking day in the United States. I was in New York, and I think the morning after, it was similar to London the morning after Brexit, which is that everyone was sort of in a state of shock and mourning. And I'm not someone who gets easily beaten down, but for a few days, I also kind of had this feeling of hopelessness. And I think a lot of people had that. And the Women's March as an idea was introduced. And I think for the first time, that gave people something to latch onto, something to hang onto. We all need tangible things to do when we are faced with systemic problems. Because we can analyze them, we can understand them all we want, but we need tangible actions to take. Otherwise, how can we keep going? It's not possible. So the first thing that I think Women's March did was provided a clear, tangible action that people could sort of sink their teeth into. Now, I think as many people know, you know, there were struggles in the initial creation of the march. And one of those struggles is sort of the age-old problem of feminism in America, which is that throughout the history of women's rights in the United States, there has been an unspoken yet very clear focus on white women's rights, and particularly white upper-middle-class women's rights. So suffrage, for example. We love to say in the United States, women got the right to vote in 1920. We didn't. Not all women got the right to vote. White women got the right to vote in 1920. It was not until there are a number of different citizenship laws that took place later on of people, for example, Asian American immigrants. It wasn't until the 40s that citizenship was finally established, and so Asian American women weren't able to vote. Same thing with indigenous women and voting rights that happened much later because of citizenship laws. And then, of course, Jim Crow, the laws that made it incredibly difficult and near impossible for black folks in the South to vote, meant that black women were not able to vote until the Civil Rights Act was passed. And still, there is voter disenfranchisement now in terms of the fact that people in prison can't vote and more. So that's suffrage. Then you have the 60s and 70s, the feminist movement, which completely, again, centered on white women and largely heterosexual white women. And then you have feminism now. And when Women's March was first announced, it was initially called Million Women's March, which is a march that already had happened. It was a march that black women held. And so this initial announcement was a very clear representation of sort of how out of touch many white women feminists were with the very strong and real and long struggle of black women feminists in the United States. Just no awareness of that. So what I think I'm most proud of is that Women's March has consistently said, when we've been faced with very real critiques, instead of sort of, as we discussed in the last panel, instead of shutting down, instead of sort of reacting with shame, as I think it is very easy for us to do on the left, we have this image of who we are, and so when that is challenged, we feel shame and sort of shrink into ourselves. We opened up the conversation. And, you know, the women who initially started it said, you're right. We fucked up. This was wrong. And brought in leadership of women of color. And as my sister, Linda Sarsour, loves to say, if you're not following women of color, you're not doing it right. And that's really what we believe. So that, I think, is one of the first steps to take what is the feminist movement in the United States and really challenge the dominant narrative of what that looks like, what feminism in America looks like. And taking it and saying it cannot be about white women. It has to explicitly be about all of the intersecting identities that women hold. And I think that's important, and I say that because many people sort of see the march as just a reaction to the election or just an attempt to sort of fight back against Trump. And it was in many ways, but that is in no way the whole story, and it can't be. Because the problems that the United States has when it comes to systemic inequality, when it comes to injustice, when it comes to harm and violence, have existed long before Donald Trump was elected president, and they will exist long after he is no longer president, whether he is impeached, or whether his term limits run out, or whether he dies. It's just, they will not go away. And so we cannot address the problems as if they only exist for one man. So that's why I'm answering the question with sort of what I hope is not a too long overview of American feminism, because that, I think, sets the stage of what Women's March is, what we do, and the type of resistance movement that we see ourselves as.
Thank you. I think you already touched upon a question that I had, is the sort of the internal struggles of who is part of the campaign, who's taking part, and when it's taken to the streets. I think the interesting link here is that your march is deliberately named Women's March, even though there were other people there too, right? Whereas abortion in Poland, abortion is of course a topic that is relevant to all genders, but I think it's fair to say that women are most affected, and that's why, you know, you can mobilize them much more easily. And still in Poland, we saw that the audiences were very mixed, which I think is a very optimistic sign. And my question to both of you is, what have you seen sort of in the formation of those marches, those campaigns, in terms of allyship? Were there surprises? Were there disappointments? And how did you navigate those?
This one is working? Yeah, thank you. I must say that What happened on 3rd of October in Poland for me, being active in the feminist movement since 1993, was a huge surprise. Huge surprise because I was in the protest that there were 20 or 30 of us protesting for women's rights, protesting for access to abortion, protesting against domestic violence, protesting against discrimination for many years. Even 2 years before black protests, I saw the photos of the group of protesters in front of parliament with nearly the same slogans, the group of 100. So it was exactly what you said. The problems are not caused by conservatives or right-wingers. The problems were caused by system, but the selection, the result of election affected with the resistance of those who were always questioning the system, but bring new allies. And for me, what was, well, in Poland, we don't talk about abortion openly. It's illegal. We don't talk about women's rights because it's linked with feminism, and feminism is not cool, and it's a bad word, bad F word. But if it starts to, well, if the lawmakers are starting to influence our privacy with that huge strength as it was proposed by Polish government, because what government was supporting the complete on abortion, including 3 years of prison for women that was under suspicion that she had an abortion. So miscarriage could lead woman to spend 3 years in prison. That was the proposal of civil bill. Like in Salvador, though, as we are in European Union, just 3 years instead of 30. Women did understand what does this mean to them, and what does it mean, especially to those who are poorer. Because rich women would manage, would travel abroad, would come to Germany and have safe abortion. But poorer, those who don't have the access to education, who don't have an education, because we don't have also a sexual education on a decent level in Poland, those who are not even aware of the fact how they can get pregnant or how they can use contraceptives, they are in a big troubles, let's say. And that was another unexpected relief for us, because women who were entered the protest, who joined the protest, they decided not to go because they want to have a right to abortion. They went to have to show their support for fight for women's rights. And well, I think all was surprise. Surprise was the march in small villages consisting of 14, 15 people protesting in their small town, standing in the rain, knowing that all locals are watching at her and at them, and they are showing that they are pro-choice, but they are also pro-feminism. Big surprise were actors and celebrities who never even care about equality, who never talked about women's rights or oppression that women are suffering, who surprisingly realized that it's quite cool to have a photo on a Facebook with hashtag black protest and be dressed in black. Very big surprise. Then it was a big surprise to hear some men from mainstream saying that, well, actually, although we are not supporting all those feminist issues, we think black protest is a very good idea because we will show the middle finger to the ruling party. That's why we would support. And another big ally were journalists. Women journalists working in their televisions, radios, magazines, those who usually are discriminated, who are facing mobbing, discrimination in their work. Finally, they thought it's their fight, not only for abortion right, but for presence, for visibility, for having a power. And because of so many things, black protests were successful. Because of the courage of women in the countryside that were brave enough to go to protest in their local towns, not going to the big cities where it's easy, but stand in front of the local headquarters of the party and protest. A journalist who supported us, celebrities who started to be feminist, young girls that decided not to go to school or go to school dressed black, because that was the concept of protest, that either you are taking on strike or you are just dressed black. And when you see teachers dressed black and kids dressed black, boys and girls, you know that something is changing, and you know that society is changing, because then, on the very local level, they see alliances, and they see how their relations are changing in common fight and common struggle, not only for abortion, for equality.
So I think to answer this question, I want to just bring up the word, a word that maybe everyone knows. Actually, show of hands, who's familiar with the political concept of intersectionality? Great, okay. if you don't, turn to your neighbor quickly, look it up. So that was the premise of the Women's March, and by virtue of that, every single progressive issue was included in the march. We had a really widespread platform that we called our Unity Principles, and it covered everything from mass incarceration to climate change to disability justice. Because the entire concept is that women, of course, hold intersecting identities, and if we are not fighting for all of those identities, we are not fighting for all women. So, So in terms of new allies, I think the Women's March was sort of a critical moment of progressive groups that never usually talk to one another because they're accustomed to operating as single issue organizations coming together under one banner. One example of this is that we had no corporate sponsors because we didn't want to be accountable to any corporate money, but we did have nonprofit organizations that were helping to fund the march. And the three biggest sponsors were the NRDC, which is the National Resource Defense Council, that's an environmental justice group, Planned Parenthood, which I think everybody knows about, and an organization called The Gathering for Justice, which focuses on mass incarceration. And these three logos were on one banner together above a sign that said Women's March. And I have never before seen, and I'm young, but you know, have been an activist for a bit and studied activism for a while, I've never before seen environmental justice, reproductive justice, and criminal justice reform united under one banner. And I think that that is the only way that we can move forward, is when we are all committed to fighting for the issues that might not directly impact us at face value or at first glance, but that are deeply interconnected. And I can go into a little bit about how they connect, but I think, you know, you're a smart group. I think you can make a lot of those leaps on your own. But that matters because we are so used to seeing our issues as in competition with each other for funding, for national attention, for lobbying power. And the minute that we fall into that trap, we are erasing the idea that we can hold multiple identities at once. And what we need is a joint political power. We need the people who will mobilize for the environment to also mobilize for the rights of incarcerated people. We need people who will mobilize around women's health to mobilize around anything else, around disability justice, around police violence, because all of these issues matter, and we cannot continue only having specific groups that only show up for one reason, because that doesn't work. We've seen that. It's not powerful enough. It matters. It makes small reforms, but it's not powerful enough. But the reason that 5 million people marched on January 21st is because that they all saw their issues represented. And everyone had a way, again, to latch on and grab onto it, because everyone knew that all progressive issues were immediately under threat. But everyone also knew that all of those issues impact women. And that's sort of the uniting factor. So anyone, first of all, we said anyone who believes that women's rights are human rights is welcome, which is a pretty broad swath of people, thankfully. But that was sort of an important moment of forging those coalitions. Now, what's interesting sort of afterwards is seeing how we've been operating since. And I'm really happy to say that I've seen enormous groups working together nonstop. And one thing that you have often never seen before is groups sort of going out of their way to lend their platforms to other organizations, particularly smaller organizations. It's a very rare thing to do. We're all territorial, and you know, it can be hard to avoid ego. But again, commitment to resistance work that we're engaging in has to be larger than our commitment to our individual organizations, because it's bigger than all of us. So we've been, at Women's March, very intentional about trying to elevate the work of smaller groups, but we also see other groups doing this as well. And it's so exciting to see, for example, Greenpeace tweeting about reproductive rights. Because that, again, that is what matters. But what's also interesting is that we are sort of pushing our way in. We're sort of, Women's March operates in an interesting space between sort of new resistance movements, really great new organizations like Indivisible is probably the top one I would think of. But also, many of us are people who've been active in the movement for Black Lives for quite some time. And even though our organization is predominantly staffed by women of color, it's led by women of color, we are still seen as a white woman's movement in a lot of ways, and that's in part because that's who our base is. That's who sort of follows us. And we know that, and you know, it's important to, I think, meet people where they're at and speak to the people who are showing you love and show them love back, but also challenge them when you need to. So because of that perception of Women's March, there was sort of initial distrust from folks in, say, the Movement for Black Lives of our organization, completely understandably so. This idea of, you know, all of these white women decided to show up in Washington, D.C. on January 21st, and where were they every single time before then? Which is a valid argument and certainly, you know, a question I've also had. And I'm sure many of you have had as well. But what's been powerful is to see what happens when we sit down and have conversations with each other and demonstrate our commitment to showing up. And so right now, for example, I'm not sure how much folks follow sort of what happens with police violence in the United States, but very recently there were there was one case, a woman, Charlena Lyles, in Seattle, who was a pregnant mother of three, with a mental illness, was shot and killed by Seattle police, who she called to report a burglary. So she called them for help, and they killed her, and which happens quite frequently. And then the other case is Philando Castile, who was killed in Minnesota by police last year, and his killer was very recently acquitted of all charges, including the charge of firing a weapon recklessly, which he did. So a lot of folks might think that's not initially, particularly with Philando Castile, that's not initially a women's issue. But of course it is. One, because we know that women absolutely are targets of police violence. We know that Black women and Native women are disproportionately impacted by police violence among women as a whole. And also, there are mothers and wives and children and community members. So it does matter to all of us. And what's been powerful to see is white women who identify with the Women's March in Minneapolis, which is the, you know, which is in Minnesota where a lot of the organizing is happening, showing up and standing next to groups like Black St. Paul that are organizing and getting angry and transferring their anger to not just say Donald Trump is a threat to me, but local police are a threat to my sisters and brothers of color, and therefore they're a threat to me.
Thank you. Barbara, I see you are taking notes. Would you like to add something on the Polish context?
Well, I was thinking what you were saying, and it same case, but you had two main difference. I see two main differences between our protests. You said sponsors, and you had time. We had just 10 days. Just 10 days from the day the parliament rejected the bill to liberalize the abortion law and decided to proceed this unhuman law that was complete ban on abortion. From that day to the protest was 9 days, 10 days, just like this. And in those days, we managed to prepare something that huge, something that stopped far right, something that woke women's conscience and make them fight. But the difference is that you had to explain about Donald Trump and what he would do and how would the environment affect, his action would affect society. Whereas we had a topic already made by far right, because they wanted actually to put us in prison. And put us under the suspicion since from our first period to our last period. So that is the difference, and that what was really making Polish women so angry and so involved without this networking. But on the other hand, we worked on a very similar method. You said that you were networking a lot. Polish women were networking really a lot, was preparing documents with lawyers, announcing that if someone will be in trouble, just let me know. I will fight for you in court. Or teachers protecting their kids, or professor at the university on 3rd of October asking her students, "What the hell are you doing here? You should be protesting on the streets." "I am here because I have to, and I will join your protest later on. But you have to be there already." So we had this networking. We had trust. We had trust towards each other, that if someone is saying, "I will organize a protest here," yes, please, free to do so. If journalists were calling, because I was mainly working with media and journalists, I was telling them what's going on, and I knew that I can trust them, and also they trusted me. And we also trusted each other on how it will be organized, or how the parties and organization will find their space, finding a compromise between identity, political identity, party identity, organizational identity, and the common cause that was brought us on the street, and openness. So if there was someone coming and saying, "I want to do a demonstration here," or "I want to close the kindergarten I am working or I am owing because of the black protest. Could you help me, or would you support me?" Yes, that's how it worked. Very spontaneous, very open, because we knew that we fight in a kind of huge solidarity gesture towards each other. And seeing 90-year-old woman in the protest for abortion, saying, "I'm not here for myself, I'm not here for my daughter, I am here for my great-granddaughter," or mothers with their children and their mothers together in the protest, or boyfriends with girlfriends, or boyfriends with boyfriends on the same protest, saying, "We are all human, we believe what you exactly said, that women's rights are human rights, and we are standing here in this rain, to show our solidarity for human right, actually." And just one thing, the symbol of our protests are the black umbrellas. It wasn't invented, really. It was so spontaneous because it was raining. And Poland is actually quite a kind of dull country. When it rains quite often, we are usually dressed in black. That's why black protest was so easy to be implemented. That it's really our favorite color to be dressed, and we all complain constantly. Well, indeed, Polish activists would confirm that it's our nature. And it was raining, so we took the umbrellas, and obviously everyone had black umbrella, except a small group of LGBT who had rainbow umbrellas. That's what make the protests so sometimes colorful, but rather black protest. But firstly, a cause, a thing that we were fighting for many years, a background prepared by feminist movement since 90s, and then spontaneous act after, and what worked really, I think, the debate in parliament. Far right proposed their bill through the civil initiative. So 100,000 signatures to the parliament and compulsory debate in parliament. We did the same. I was speaking in the plenary of parliament in favor of liberalization of abortion law because we managed to bring 250,000 of signatures in 3 months to have this as a debate. All media showed this. All media showed awful debate with ultra-conservatives offending women, offending equality, offending justice, offending democracy. It was very difficult, also for me personally, to listen nonsenses. about women, about equality, about the abortion. But it worked, as we show the clash of, well, the clash of civilization, the civilization of freedom and civilization of oppression. We lost in parliament, we won on the streets.
Thank you. Sophie, I know you want to answer, but I would like to open the floor to the audience. We're running terribly behind schedule. We will eat a little bit into your lunch break. I hope you don't mind, because we also still have two little videos to show. But let's collect three questions, and then I know that both of you are going to stay around. I know, you know, working and eating is not a good combination, but I'm sure, you know, people will find you. So let's take the mic. Is it on?
Yes.
We have more than three questions.
Excellent. There's a lot of solidarity in getting the mic to one specific person.
It's only because I didn't get it at the last session, so that's where the lobbying is. Okay. I'm Gosia. I'm from the Warsaw Fellowship and from Poland. And I'd like to add a little bit of bitterness into this optimistic picture, which of course I'm very proud of what we achieved, like we as the Polish society, I would say, with the Black protests. However, what I've observed afterwards and the work of the very diverse groups is the victory of coalition politics and cause politics, as I would call it. So we were fighting for the cause and forgetting for a moment and on our identity focus, I would say. But also later on, when there were other manifestations, what I observed was the kind of not lack of understanding or being afraid from the side of, I would say, majority groups, like major women's groups, who were opposing that, for example, lesbian activist or lesbian person was taking a stage and talking about the right to abortion, or a trans person was. And for me personally, that was very hard to kind of get through my head and like kind of get over my anger with that, because I saw many, many comments saying that it's not a trans issue, it's not a lesbian issue, it's women's issue. So it's like cis woman, heterosexual issue. So I'm thinking, like, what lesson hasn't been made, or what did we not think about enough during, like, of course, it was very spontaneous. So I'm not saying, like, when the Black protest took place, but afterwards. I think what's happening also still at the moment, that we can't get through the picture of, like, it's women's issue. And personally, I have a lot of problems with saying, like, it's women's march or it's women's thing. Because if not women's march and it's not women's thing, it's the cause, it's the reproductive rights thing. This is the cause. So I'm thinking, like, how can we make, and this is a question both to both speakers, like, how can we make this cause or coalition more effective in terms of really making it inclusive, not only on paper or in declaration, but in real practical way?
Thank you for the question. We're collecting two more.
Hi, I'm Lydia. I'm a U.S. fellow in the Berlin program, and I think my question is probably more directed towards Sophie. So I know you were talking about how the base of the Women's March was mostly white, even though, you know, your intentions were clear and trying to be inclusive. But I wonder, I guess it's kind of like, how do you also deal with kind of like the ignorance of the masses? Because I see as a valid critique that the Women's March in practice was, in its kind of symbols and slogans, kind of turned out to be transphobic and racist. And so I guess as an organizer, what do you do when your intention isn't reflected in perception? Because then if people feel like, if trans people feel that they're excluded, you know, they won't show up and they won't become a part of it, and then the perception becomes reality. So I guess as an organizer, how do you fight that? that your intention isn't what is perceived.
Thank you, Lydia. Are we having a question from that end of the spectrum? Take glasses.
Hello, I'm Vlasis. I did part on the last year fellowship program in Berlin. I have maybe simple questions because I thank you for your nice talking. It's interesting for me to know more information. I would like to ask the role of the Christian Catholic Church because I don't know, because I know that Poland is one of the most, so to say, I don't know, the church maybe plays a very important role. And to your case, it would be interesting because you said about police violence is among people of color and other kind of groups very often. What do you do, what actions, or what do you do to protect those people? Or if you can say an example, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, who would like to start?
I'm happy to start. So first, I want to address your question, and thank you for asking it because I think it's an important one. And that was hard. I mean, for example, everyone I think knows about the pink pussy hats, which was started by someone else outside of the Women's March, and I think that's a really perfect example of sort of something taking off and resonating with a lot of people, and then not resonating with a lot of people, but it's sort of taking off outside of our control. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of them. I don't happen to have one. Again, I'm speaking personally. You know, we know that not all women have vaginas, and we know that not all vaginas are pink, and that's just a simple fact. So they're definitely problematic, and I agree with that. I think it's a hard question of how do we address something that, again, has taken off, and that so many people who do follow and support us seem to really connect with when it fundamentally goes against or when it fundamentally is triggering and painful for the very people who are most marginalized and who we are most committed to centering in the work that we're doing. So I think one of the first ways that we go about that is through education. And that's sort of something we've been committed to doing throughout, which is not necessarily saying, and again, I think ideally it would be great if we could just say, hey, here's why the pussy hats might be transphobic and maybe you might want to rethink them. But again, and this is talking strategically, we had the unique opportunity of engaging millions of women who had never previously engaged in activism before. A lot of sort of white, middle-class women who either had never been politically active or haven't been politically active for decades. And that is important. That's a group with political power. And that's a group that has power and power that can be directed into issues they might not automatically think of. So I think one of the first things is by emphasizing over and over and over again to our base that trans women are women, that fighting for trans justice is absolutely integral to fighting for women's rights, and perhaps sort of hoping that those conclusions are people come to those conclusions on their own. But one thing that we've also done is tried to really highlight the voices of people who have dissented to certain things that we've done, and not hiding from them. So someone, when we first released our policy platform, there's a disability rights activist who I'm a huge fan of. Her name's Emily Ladeau. She published a piece in The Establishment that ran through our platform and said, here are all the ways you could have included disability and you didn't. And it was great. And instead of, you know, pushing it away, we shared it. And we said, everyone should read this, and she's right. And so I think that's sort of one of the best ways to do it, is instead of using our position to specifically talk to people, I think it's highlighting the voices of people who make those incredibly important arguments and saying you need to listen to other people in this movement who are with you, because the people standing by you don't feel safe and don't feel okay. rather than us standing, because at the same time, we also, you know, I don't believe that we are in any way leaders of a movement. I think of it as a leaderful movement. I think of us perhaps as like temporary caretakers of a movement. And so the idea that we are sort of the sole directors is not something that I think that we or I personally, you know, want to encourage. So I think encouraging people to listen to the people next to them who have their own complaints and their own problems is what's critical. But I also won't pretend that it's a solved issue. And I think it's something that we're committed to continuing to work on. But, you know, I don't have a good enough answer for it. And I don't want to pretend that I do. And then, while I have the mic, quickly, I'll address police violence. So this is, I'm going to separate between myself representing Women's March and myself personally. Because personally, I don't believe that you should call the police. Personally, I think we see time and again that calling the police puts people in danger. And that police make some people safe, and they make some people very unsafe. And the decision to engage with police and to sort of follow that authority is a decision that completely ignores how unsafe they make many people, and particularly people of color and disabled people who are also disproportionately impacted by police violence. So one of the things you see in the United States is that there is not adequate emergency response for people in the middle of mental health crises, and police become the default response. And over and over again, we see that police don't actually know how to respond to people in the middle of a mental health crisis any other way than harming them. You know, it's seen as a problem to contain, not a person who is in need of help. So I personally believe, don't call the police. And I think, I know a lot of people might disagree with that. I know that seems like a hard thing to say. It's something we're sort of taught that, you know, police are the law. But I think that, you know, speaking about American police in particular, I think that policing is a fundamentally racist institution and a violent institution. And as for solutions or alternatives, I think we have to start thinking about what it looks like to keep our own communities safe, to protect each other. So one thing that was really exciting is there's this Google Doc that's floated around activist communities. And it's like a 60-page document that's things to do instead of calling the police. And it's sort of a group, like a brainstorm that different people have anonymously contributed to talk about what are the different ways that we can keep each other and our communities safe without putting other people in danger. Because we also have to look at what happens after you call the police, even if they don't kill someone or hurt someone. And that's that then you enter someone into a criminal justice system, which is also a violent institution. So that's where the issue of restorative justice comes in. And the idea of restorative justice is instead of focusing on punishing the person who has harmed, it is healing the person who has been harmed. And healing doesn't always look like punishing someone else. I would argue that it's not, actually. Although, you know, healing looks different for different people. So I think the answer is, one, building trust with your community so that you can trust each other to care for each other. Community accountability to each other. When we see something happening, we don't just turn a blind eye or we don't just call the police and then walk away. But we stay there, and maybe we call the police, and we stay there, and we're ready to film if we need to. But I think it is about committing to each other and committing to each other's safety. And that's why, I mean, I believe that, you know, I'm not safe unless everyone else is safe. And I think this actually speaks to the issue of abortion, too. If we live in a world where the government can regulate women's bodies, we live in a world where the government can regulate anybody's body, right? So if we live in a world where people whose job is to uphold the law can kill people with impunity, we live in a country where the government can just kill people with impunity. And that's not safety. So that would be my response. It might not be a popular one, but...
I will start with a question about the role of Christian Catholic Church. So if you ask me what is the role of Catholic Church, I would answer too big. But why? And is it real big in society? Firstly, during the communism, church in Poland was one of the places of resistance. And majority of opposition leaders in the 80s were very closely linked to Christian Catholic Church, no matter if they were atheists, Jews, or Christian Catholics. But when changes and when Iron Curtain collapsed and changes started, many of them decided to have close link to Christian Catholic Church, especially those right-winger Catholics, and they decided to pay their debts from the 80s. And the first victims of the debts were women, because they were paying their debts from the elections, from the support, in women's body and women's rights. That's why one of the first laws that was changed after Iron Curtain collapse was changing the law on abortion, whereas in the 80s it was legal, and in 1991 was illegal. Christian Catholic Church is trying to influence all legislative processes. And on one hand, it has its right. I mean, every NGOs can try to influence legislative process. The question is how politicians do respond. And the problem is that in Poland, politicians do respond very often positively. And there is kind of myth that if you don't have the support of Christian Catholic Church, you would not win the elections. The problem is that you might have a support of Christian Catholic Church and it does not give you the guarantee to win the elections, which was shown even recently, where both conservative parties, the ruling one, Law and Justice, and the previous conservative Civic Platform, had their support from Christian Catholic Church. But then in society, it's different. There are parts of Poland that are very religious, and people do send their kids to to the church, and they do attend the church, and religion is compulsory in primary school. But as is more and more oppressive, then society more and more resistance. We have in Poland tradition of disobedience. And if Christian Catholic Church will be too powerful, simply even those who believe in God will start to disobey to their rules. Well, society is changing as well. Also, Catholic Church sometimes is changing. In Poland, not in the way we would expect it. But me as an atheist, I'm not interested in NGOs. I'm interested in the civil state, in the state and society. And for sake of Polish society, the role of Christian Catholic Church should be separated from the role of state, which is not the case right now. And I see there is a group that knows exactly what I am referring to. And answering Kasia's question, Gosia. Answering to Gosia's question, yes, you are right, shit happens. And and remembering that demonstrations we were all involved in process of organization, brought people also with conservative views, brought this kind of feeling, especially those conservative groups who don't recognize right of LGBT or right of transgender people or right of any other minority as equal. But we had big protests in Poland to defend the Constitutional Tribunal, big protests for democracy, and we were all marching the hand in hand with Mayor of Warsaw, who decided not to give a patronage to Pride. So for her, marching for democracy is okay. Marching for democracy for LGBT is not okay at all. But what we should do is not to give up. It's to educate them. It's to educate the conservatives and the mainstream that this is our fight. If feminists in the 90s would give up, we wouldn't have the protests and the demonstrations. If we wouldn't stand for many hours in the streets on the 8th of March every year, the demonstrations wouldn't be that massive. If we wouldn't talk to journalists for many years saying, well, topic of abortion, it's not an artificial topic. It's not a topic that we just want to have because we don't want to talk about finances or budget in society. we managed to talk about this for many years. We managed to convince also society that these issues are important. So this is the next step, to convince the society, those groups who participated in the protest, that the right of LGBT people are part of our fight, that the fight for equality is not fight for equality for selected group, it's equality for all, no matter of age, sex, ability or religion or lack of religion. What shall we do? Work with them, talk to them, convince them. I know it's boring, I know it's difficult sometimes, sometimes it's hopeless and pointless, but then no matter what they are saying, go to the demonstration, take a floor, and what my colleague did on one demonstration, she took the floor and she said, I am a lesbian and I am for abortion and I am for choice because I'm fighting for my future, but I'm also fighting for future of other women because it's solidarity. And this is what we should do. And ask for support of those you know might support you. Not all of them would support you, not everyone who was at the protest on October were supporting the right to abortion. But in this very divisive moment, the conservatives were forced to say if they are anti-choice or not. If they are not, they are pro-choice. And when we had debate in parliament, that was the first time that conservative party called Civic Platform, that was formerly running Poland, was voting in favor of pro-choice regulations. I know they are not pro-choice, but they were voting. So they changed a little bit their mind. It's a hard work with society, but no one said that life is easy. We are facing this all the time. And what is necessary to find the supporters that will stand with LGBT groups, that will stand with disabled groups, that will stand with transgender groups, and would say, we are giving them floor because it's their fight, because human rights are for every human being.
Thank you, Barbara. Very quickly.
Yes, thank you. To very quickly add on to that, I would say, you know, I think we should challenge our allies, not shut them out, but challenge them always. I think, you know, people are constantly saying on the left, like, oh, but, you know, we're so split already, you know, don't pick a fight with the people who are with you. But if you're not with all of us, you're not actually with us, right? So I think we have to be constantly pushing people to show up and show up better. I wouldn't be, you know, the activist I am today if people hadn't challenged me to confront my own internalized racism or my own internalized transphobia, right? Like that, we have to constantly work on ourselves and we have to constantly work on the people around us. Now, I would say that I think it's the obligation of every single person with a certain element of privilege to talk to people who have that same privilege, because we can't put the burden of that work on people who are simply trying to survive as themselves.
Thank you, Sophie. I really would like to thank both of you for a very inspiring session. I think, you know, the communication with the audience already sort of tells you, you know, on what fertile ground a lot of the things that you said fell. And while we're emptying the space, I would like to ask Herman to show us the next little film, which talks about Native American history, an action project by Rue George Warren.
The struggles of indigenous peoples in the United States continue to be ignored for many reasons, including their marginalization in spaces dedicated to public education, such as museums, historical sites, and the public education system. From Indigenous Peoples Day, October 10th, 2016, until Inauguration Day, January 20th, 2017, as part of the Indigenous Corps of Discovery, Humanity in Action Senior Fellow Rue George Warren curated and gave truth-telling tours of the Smithsonian's Presidential Portrait Gallery to more than 150 people. Each tour lasted nearly an hour and presented audiences with a research-based Indigenous retelling of United States presidential history. At the center of the tour are stories from Rue's own community, Catawba Indian Nation, and their interactions with Presidents Washington, Jackson, Nixon, and George W. Bush, demonstrating how his community has been poorly treated throughout U.S. history despite their contributions to American society. In addition to these personal community tales, Stories from other indigenous communities are told to highlight U.S. policies of destruction, removal, and assimilation, and Native American survivance. The tours received overwhelmingly positive feedback from tour attendees and generated interest from Native and non-Native researchers and journalists. Hyperallergic.com, one of the most popular online arts magazines in the United States, published an interview with Rue regarding Indigenous Corps of Discovery and the Dakota Access Pipeline fight. Professors from Haxel Tribal College and Emmanuel College have expressed their intention to teach the project in their contemporary American art classes during the spring 2017 semester. After completing an audio tour of the exhibition, Rue aims to turn his attention to securing funding to produce Indigenous Corps of Discovery tours at other locations, including the Smithsonian Museum of American History. He aspires to recruit and train other Indigenous storytellers to give their own tours in their local institutions. Ultimately, he hopes that by expanding the project to include many diverse Indigenous voices, the tour can grow into a real movement for demanding institutional responsibility to Indigenous peoples.